Oh. All right. So, yeah.
He's not mine. So, again, I'm pretty sure I said it to you last class.
If I didn't,
I'll say it now. History's hard. Understanding history's hard because history is nothing but a series of events that sometimes inspire the next event or is impacted by the event that comes before. But the problem is sometimes it's not always a straight line. So when I was an undergrad, the focus of my professors was always cause and effect. What caused it? What was the effect of the event? And that's how we focused on it. The problem is sometimes events are just so big that trying to figure out why it happened is more confusing than the event itself. But the event won't make sense unless you struggle to try to figure out the cause. And ironically, this is one of those events that the cause is probably more important than the effects of the event. And this is definitely one of the most complex of all of the events of the late medieval period, sometimes referred to as the High Middle Ages. The Hundred Years' War. What makes this a good event to study is that it was reflective of many of the events that were going on throughout Europe. So you don't have time to talk about everything that was going on. So I've picked things to highlight what was going on. It's like you could spend the entire 3 hours watching the Detroit Lions on their way to the Super Bowl, but you only had to watch one play when a stupid mistake was made. When in doubt, always go for the 3 points. But no. Well, this is true. We don't have to study everything that was going on in the continent because this one event gives us a snapshot. Because the truth be told, feudalism, which we talked about, I think last class, the class before, was ultimately the cause of this. In order to be a king during this time, you were not all powerful. You were nothing more than another noble. But the only way to secure the throne was through alliances of other nobles. Of course, there was the hierarchy. There was the superior lord and the inferior lord. But still, it was complicated. It was based on personal relationships. And ultimately, that was the cause of this war. It was a flaw of feudalism. Because in order to control your land, you had to be loyal to the lord above you. But if you thought you were more powerful than the lord above you, you challenged that lord because you were nothing but another noble just like them. And ultimately, it culminated in warfare. So, the Hundred Years' War largely took place in France. And it has to do with the fact, like I mentioned last class, when I was talking about how complex the relationship between Philip and Richard was. The truth be told was going again, just to be repetitive, going back to 1066, the Duke of Normandy invaded England and conquered it and made himself king, William the Conqueror. But in order to control his lands, he simultaneously was a vassal of the French king. So, Who is he going to fight for? Is he going to fight for the French king if it could threaten his throne? Or is he going to focus on the English lords and their demands at the expense of his French lord? Complicating things was the great-grandson of William, Henry II, who became king. From his mother and his relations, he not only had Normandy, but he, he inherited other lands. He simultaneously was the Duke of Normandy, the Duke of Anjou, and the Duke of Brittany. Plus, he got married to arguably one of the most famous women of the medieval period, Eleanor of Aquitaine, who from her father, she inherited this whole southern section of France. Now, Eleanor originally was married to Louis VII, the loser of the Second Crusade. But the guy was such a loser, she actually filed with the Pope a petition to get an annulment. Why? She couldn't produce a son. And Louis was being a bastard to her. So she was more powerful in wealth than her king husband. So she sought for a separation, and the Pope granted her the separation. But yet, lo and behold, she then gets married to Henry II, King of England, and they have two sons. So at the end, it wasn't her, it was her husband. So now, Henry II is King of England. And, oh, by the way, I got a legal concept which I want to share with you. It's critical that you understand this. Legal concept of unity. Anyone hear this before? So one of the things that feminists often lie about is they say, oh, back in the day, women had no rights, women had no privileges. Of course, it's not actually true. It's kind of false information. Truth of the matter is women did have rights, but, it wasn't me, but when they got married, their rights became one with their husband. They were unified. They were once separate beings, but then when they got joined, they became one. So, when she divorced her husband, Louis VII, she took her stuff with her, legally, rightfully. It was hers. And she brought it to the new marriage. And the moment she said, I did, what was hers became his. And thus, unity. So, had she stayed with Louis, he could have governed these lands as if they were his. But the moment she went and married Henry, suddenly the King of England owns almost half, if not a little more than half, of France. Those are his legal domains. But the catch is, in order for him to possess those lands, he still must pay homage, which we talked about previously, to his lord. So he must bow down, kneel down before the French king. The French king must accept his offering. And the English king, as Duke of these lands,
must provide taxes and soldiers when called upon.
All right. Questions. All right, now let's fast forward to the time we were talking about.
During the reign of Philip II,
who fought in the King's Crusade, Philip II Augustus, in 1202, he triggered a war with England. Now, Philip happened to be the son of Louis VII, who got married two times after Eleanor and eventually had a son. Bless you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And there had actually been a peace treaty in place between Philip and, at the time, the King of England, John. John the First was Richard the Lionheart's younger brother.
The Lionheart actually died in the war that Richard triggered when he returned from the Third Crusade.
Tragic story. Richard, big, tall, kingly man, alpha male, led men from the front, was at a siege. He decides to walk out of the protection to observe what was going on, and out of sheer luck, on top of the French castle, there's a French cook who's bored, goes up to the top of the castle, is kind of screwing around with one of the guards, like having fun, not like the sex stuff. Just joshing around. And the guard like lets him look at a crossbow. And for giggles, the guard takes the crossbow and shoots it over the top of the castle. And a bolt comes down and actually hits the king in the chest. King would die a few days later. Gruesome, painful death. And ironically, Richard actually had a chance to meet the cook. And he actually forgave him. According to legend, he basically said, "Wow, yeah, that was a good shot. Nice job. So what if you killed me?" But again, that's what alpha kings do. They admire bravery. Alright, so anyways, Richard's dead. John becomes king. And John II, as King of England, Duke of all of those lands, technically becomes vassal of Philip II. But when Philip summoned John to Paris to attend court, one of the things that he should have done, John refuses. And when you refuse a call of your lord, that could be declared to be a violation of your oath of homage. So long story short, 1202, out of revenge, Philip declares war and managed to conquer much of the English territory. Anjou, Brittany, Normandy, and half of Aquitaine are taken. All of this gets reduced to that. Now, in the end, this Anglo-French war would result in a French victory. Now, ironically, events that occur in the past do leave a ripple that can influence events yet to happen. And this was a good example of that. Because one of the weird tangential consequences of the fact that John refused to go and bow down before the king when summoned, resulting in a complete humiliation of John in the English forces, was John's famous nickname. He would be known to history as King John Lackland, in recognition of the fact that he lost hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres of French land because of his incompetency. Now here's the weird tangent. And this is one of the things that history fascinates me about. Is that as a result of this loss, there actually was a rebellion in England. When the barons, the English barons, rebelled against the king because the king wanted to raise taxes. And the king actually lost the rebellion. And the barons imposed upon him none other than the Great Charter, the Magna Carta. Any of you ever hear of the Magna Carta before? When I was in high school, I had to study the Magna Carta. Because when I was in high school, we had a class called civics. And we learned about government. You had physics? Civics? Did you really? Nice. What school system?
Princeton High School.
Where? Really good. That's good. You had it too?
Nice.
You did too?
Good.
They took it away. Not many students for a while. I'm glad to hear that they're bringing it back. I would make you take nothing but civics in high school. Yeah. You start off with the local government, then you figure out the state government, and then you finally get up to the national government. You'd be also smart. Well, you may not know this, but the basis of our U.S. constitutional system, America itself, is based upon some of the key principles that the barons forced upon John because John refused to go to Paris to appear before the king. For example, in Magna Carta, the first clause discusses the concept of freedom of religion. Now, of course, this is a big misnomer in our country. People intentionally misinterpret the First Amendment to religious clauses to mean something that it's not. We don't have separation of church and state in our Constitution. No. What we have is block on the federal government from making a national church and the allowance of every person to be as religious or non-religious as they choose. That's what's said in the First Amendment. Well, that comes from the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta expressly states that the government cannot control the church. The church is in charge of the church, not the king. Read the Constitution. Clause 1 of the Bill of Rights. It literally says the national government is barred from establishing a church. So it can't do what England would do during the time of Henry VII, when the king would make himself the head of the church, and everyone would be first forced to give taxes to the Church of England. That's what the Founding Fathers were referring to, because that goes all the way back to the Magna Carta. Clause 12. No scutage or age may be levied. That's old-timey English. We're basically saying no taxes. Without consent of the barons. The
barons at the time served as a council, which were kind of like the legislative branch.
So as the Sons of Liberty famously said, no taxation without representation. One of the things that the kings used to do was basically demand people pay taxes
without getting permission.
So going all the way back to the Magna Carta, the kings were forced to summon a council of the barons, and the kings had to ask the barons for their consent. Same thing like our current president, or any president, can't say there's going to be new taxes. No. Under our Constitution, it has to be passed by Congress. And the new tax has to go through both chambers of Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, before it gets to the president's desk to sign. Another important principle that comes out of Magna Carta. The government's supposed to treat the whole country equally. Prior to the Magna Carta, the king used to have his favorite towns that didn't have to pay taxes because he liked the particular lord. But he hated other lords, so he punished other communities. Well, the Magna Carta barred that. And by the way, if you read the U.S. Constitution, it states the same thing. The national government's supposed to treat all the states the same. And all of the people who live in the states, the same. We're supposed to get equal protection of the law. Old concept, but still very important, because if this was not true in the United States, you never would have had the Union. Because do you think the 13 different independent countries would have given up their rights of sovereignty to a national government if the national government was going to punish some states at the expense of others? Oh, and by the way, here's another important concept that comes out of the Magna Carta. All people, even the king, are subject to the law. So, you can't have special privileges. You cannot have special privileges. Everyone has to be treated the same. So, if you get arrested for a crime, you're supposed to get equal justice. You're supposed to have your day in court. And by the way, no one can be denied of these rights. Not only is everyone supposed to follow the law the same, but you cannot be denied due process of law. So, you're allowed to have an attorney. You're allowed to present witnesses on your own behalf. You're allowed to confront the accuser. You're allowed to mount a defense. Trial by jury. Doesn't matter if you're the king or the prince, a duke or a peasant. And by the way, that's the heart of that phrase that Thomas Jefferson put in the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equally and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. And last but not least, the system should have within it checks and balances. When we talk about the Age of Enlightenment, we're going to talk about one of the most influential philosophers on the Founding Fathers, a guy by the name of John Locke. And in his book, he wrote his book, The Second Treatise of Government, he defined what today we refer to as the social contract.
And it talks about there being checks and balances, even on the king. That the king has to be forced to do their job. And no matter who they are, they can be held accountable.
Great. Wonderful. Hugely influential piece of paper. By the way, if any of you ever go to Washington, D.C., and you go to the National Archives, there's actually a copy on the Magna Carta that you can check out before you go into the hall where the sections of all of our founding documents can be seen.
But John did something interesting. And he proved a truism. What's a piece of paper? Almost right out of the gates, John violates the document that he signed. He promised to follow the Magna Carta, and he violates it. So if the king refuses to follow the law, and the law becomes the agreement that he puts his name on, the barons respond in kind by holding them accountable. And this is where things get messy. And this is where we're going to come off of our tangent and come back into focus. Before I do so, who are you?
Me?
Yes.
Blake.
You're Blake. Okay, very good. Who also came in? You're Matt. All right, next. Questions before I go on. Again, I only threw this in there because remember, one of the most important documents, which is one of the foundations of our country, is based on the fact that a king refused to do what he wanted. And then, of course, one of the what he was supposed to do, he should have gone to Paris. But he didn't, so he got punished. And then he refused to follow his agreement. So what happens? Another conflict.
Was he punished? Oh, absolutely, because the barons would declare war on the king again for a second time. The king refused to follow his word, so the barons rebel. In an event known as the First Barons' War. This war would last about 2.5 years. And now during the war, something weird happened. Something really weird, which again is adding to the confusion of the series of events that would result in the Hundred Years' War. And of course, it's 100 years before the Hundred Years' War. All of this stuff is going on, which again is proof positive to what I said before. Sometimes figuring out why things occur is tricky. It's complicated. So what happens? Well, John violates Magna Carta, starts trying to impose taxes, starts trying to seize the lands of certain barons, and the barons unite and rebel. But during the rebellion, just proving how closely linked England and France was at the time, the barons actually reach out to France and invite the son of Philip II, the Dauphin, Prince Louis, to come to England with a French army, and if he helps the barons overthrow John, the English barons will make Prince Louis the King of England. Louis famously is known to history as Louis the Lion, very fierce. During the rebellion, he actually managed to capture about half of England. His forces were largely successful. The rebels would go so far as to actually proclaim him king. But he never had a coronation ceremony. So he was given the title of king, but he was never crowned. But during the war, there was an outbreak of dysentery. We did dysentery, right? I think we talked about that. We know what dysentery is. And during this outbreak, unfortunately, poor King John contracted dysentery and died. Well, John's death changed the Barons' War because they were fighting against John, the man. They were not rebelling against their country. This was not a revolution. Plus, John had actually given birth to a son whose name was Henry. So with John dead, the Baron sat back and said, well, we'll take the 9-year-old king and we'll crown him. Why would you want to have a 9-year-old as a king if you are a baron or a duke or a noble, a lord? You can influence him. Because is the 9-year-old going to actually rule in his own name? No, they'll appoint a regent. They'll pick one of the lords who will basically run the day-to-day affairs until the king can become an adult and rule in his own name. So for the barons, this is perfect. The dad, who we hated, is dead. We have a kid on the throne. We're going to control him for the next 12 years. We're going to end the war. So what do? They pull out of their alliance with Louis, they rally behind Henry, and they declare war on the French. Well, imagine Louis. He believes he's the king of France. I mean, king of England. Long story short, eventually the French forces are defeated. Louis is forced to retreat back to France. Questions? Well, here's the thing. The English and the French relations continue to be complicated. Because you now have a new English king, Henry, who comes of age in 1227. At that point, he's 20 years old. He spends his life preparing for war. He wants to be more like his uncle, Richard, than his father, John. One of the things that the boy dreams of as he comes into adulthood is all of the lands that his idiot father lost. He believes it's his by right. It was his property. Therefore, he should be entitled to it. But he knows the English army isn't going to stand a chance against Philip. Philip II. So he has to wait. And lo and behold, shortly after he becomes king in his own right, an opportunity arises. An opportunity arises because of death. 1223, Philip II dies, and Louis the Lion becomes king. He gets crowned as Louis VIII. But unfortunately, in 1226, there's an outbreak of dysentery in France. So he dies. But he had a son who becomes king the same year, Louis IX. But Louis is only 12 years old. Hmm. So now there's a kid king in France. What better time to invade? To make matters more significant, the Norman nobles and the Avengian nobles are begging Henry to come. They promise they will send soldiers and fight side by side with the English because they want to come back to the English Empire, not the French. So, answering the call, the war between England and France becomes a hot war. 1230, Henry lands with a huge army in Brittany. The Duke of Brittany pays homage to Henry and proclaims Henry to be the King of France. But Henry makes a mistake. Instead of fighting a pitched battle with the French, which he possibly could have won, he decides to spend his time just randomly going around the countryside, looting and pillaging. Well, in doing so, he exhausts his resources. So he's forced to make a truce and return home. Had he fought, in all likelihood, many of the French barons would have switched sides, and he possibly could have become King of France, as well as King of England. But he chose not to fight. So in many ways, he was more like his dad than he was his uncle. But this is where we got to end this conflict between him and Louis, because the next 20 years, it gets really messy. Even though technically they are in a state of war, war has been declared, there has not been a peace treaty signed. For 20 years, neither side can attack the other because they got problems. Henry has to deal with rebellions in Scotland, in Wales, in Ireland, as well as individual uprisings by English nobles. And Louis decides he's going to be a crusader. And he personally launches both the 7th and the 8th Crusades, which fail miserably. So instead of dealing with the conflict between the two, both ignore the problems. And in doing so, create other problems. It's a good lesson. If you got an issue, solve it. Don't procrastinate. But finally, 1259, both sit back and realize, oh yeah, we got this state of war between us. Let's see if we can come up with a solution. So this is the settlement. Treaty of Paris, 1259. Henry gets officially recognized as the Duke of Aquitaine. Down here. This is his territory. But he gives up his claim to Normandy, Anjou, and Maine. But in exchange, Louis also gives him Gascony and the Channel Islands, these little dots up here, which, by the way, are still English territory. So, the war's over. No 100 years war. Although, ironically, this ends 100 years of tension between the two. Two kings sit down side by side. They compromise. They split the claims in half and call it a day. But European history, any history, is not that clean. Because now we have to fast forward from 1259, when the war between the English crown and the French crown was settled, to the trigger of the next war. The more famous Hundred Years' War. And it began with the death of the King of France. The current occupant of the throne, Charles IV, dies in 1328. Here's where I'm going to confuse the hell out of all of you, but I'm going to give you a visual, and you're not going to need to know this for the test. All right. You ready? Here we go. King Louis. Okay? Well, obviously, we know we have lots of Louis. But we'll leave off with the Louis who signed the Treaty of Paris. Louis IX. Louis IX would be succeeded by his son, Philip III. Philip III would be succeeded by his son, who would take the throne as Philip IV. Have I lost you yet? All right, no, good. Here's the problem. When Philip IV died, his first son would be crowned Louis X. Louis X, however, didn't even make it as king for a year. He would catch pneumonia and he would die in June 1316. Now, when he died, his second wife was preggers. Now, here's the catch. They didn't have ultrasound. So, under French law, life began at creation, inception. So, the moment the wife was pregnant, that child was deemed to be alive and have all legal rights. There was no abortions back then. The problem is, they didn't know what the child was. No ultrasound. If it's a girl, doesn't matter. The throne would pass to Louis's brother, Philip. But until the child was born, Philip would serve as a regent. Well, a few weeks later, a child is born. And lo and behold, the child was named John. King John I of France. Sadly, John, born, John I, born, November 15, 1316, born alive, but would only live for 5 days. He has many records in French history. He is the youngest king ever to be king. He's the only person to hold title of king from the moment they were born to the moment they died. and he has the shortest reign. But John's dead. So, the crown gets passed to his uncle, who becomes Philip V. Sadly, Philip's reign only lasted 6 years. He would die of dysentery. And he has no male heir. So, he has no heir, so it has to stay in the family. That's how Charles IV becomes king. He is the youngest son of Philip IV. But now here's the problem. Charles has no male heirs. Ironically, he had a similar situation on his death that his older brother did, but his wife gave birth to a girl. So, we now have, for the first time in 500 years, the end of a ruling family. The Capetian dynasty comes to a close. The same family had been ruling France going back to 987. So now what do you do? France has not had no direct heir for 500 years. They are in unprecedented territory. So what ends up happening was a whole bunch of people comes forward and puts forward a claim. Relatives of the dead kings. Ironically, on paper, the one with the strongest claim is the daughter of Philip IV, who is actually Queen of England, Queen Isabella. Queen Isabella. Any of you ever see the movie Braveheart? Mel Gibson's movie? Scottish Rebellion? You did? Remember the French princess in there? That's Isabella. Isabella Isabella. Okay, you go. Oh, go. Isabella had been married in an arranged marriage to the king Edward I, Longshanks of England, his son, Prince Edward, who upon the death of Longshanks would become Edward II. Now, the reason for this marriage was to ideally make a close family alliance between the English throne and the French throne, to keep the 80 years of peace that had been in place. And again, it was no different because that's what kings did. If a king had a daughter, he married her off to some prince to make an alliance. But here's the catch. Isabella is no helpless princess. Isabella and the actress who portrayed her in Braveheart did a very, very, very good job. For a princess in the 14th century, she was a badass. She was not controlled by her husband. She was intelligent. She was articulate. She was brave. She was fierce. she also hated her husband. As Braveheart shows a little bit, the problem with Edward II was, and again, I'm not trying to be judgmental, I'm just saying in terms of personality, was that, well, he was a homosexual, an effeminate homosexual, in a time when alpha masculinity was the trait of a king. He would spend all his time with his, he actually had two very famous gay lovers, and he would give fancy clothes to his lovers, give them lands, give them titles, and instead of basically being a king. Who ruled the reign? Who ruled the empire? She did. She ruled the kingdom. And she didn't rule it for her husband. No, 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 no. She ruled it for her son. So, long story short, she actually has a revolution against her husband. She brings in a lover who overthrows Edward II. They arrest him. Oh, by the way, they killed his gay lover, threw him out of a palace, out of a tower, made him go splat down on the cobblestones, took him up, locked him in prison, and ended up starving him to death. Then she put her son on the throne. Fast forwards to the death of her brother. Well, what do you think she does? She travels to France, comes to Paris, meets before the French lords, and puts her son's name up as a claimant for the throne. Because as she points out, Edward III is the closest male relative. He is the grandson of Philip IV. Well, this was unprecedented, but I told you, she was fierce. She comes in, of course.
She doesn't come in all... She plays the role that she's supposed to play.
But after she submits the claim on behalf of her son, the French barons don't know what to do. So there's a great gathering. The leading barons, the bishops, the heads professors of the leading universities in France, they all gather and they start debating the issue. The problem is, on paper, do we want to have an English king? Do we want to have an English king? Well, the French did not. But if they come out and say that, that's not good politic. Because she is right. This is Philip's grandson. So what do the barons do? Well, they have to get creative. And this is where politics comes in. And this is why you never can trust politicians. Because they will find loopholes and technicalities to accomplish whatever they want. So to avoid having an English king, they go back in history. They go back to the time of the Franks. The Franks was that Germanic tribe that came into Gaul during the last century of Rome, Western Roman Empire, and carved out a Frankish kingdom. They had to go back to ancient tribal law because there was nothing on the French books that they could use to deny her. But you know what the ancient Franks said? Property could not pass through a woman. So they had to dig out a code of law, hundreds of years old, that really wasn't even the law of France, to find this technicality to tell her no. I am sure she was livid. Because she could be a woman, but she still was the child of Philip IV. So the barons told her and her son no. Well, there she is. I knew I had a picture of her. Talked about this as well, yes.
So, Isabella is the daughter of Philip IV, and you said that Edward IV was the grandson of Philip IV, so that means they are related when they got arranged marriage like that?
Edward III is her son.
Okay, Edward III is the son.
Yes.
So, who is the husband?
Edward II.
Okay, the second.
Who she overthrew and put her son on the throne.
And he's from where?
Edward II, England. Caught up? Okay. Not easy, is it? Be honest, it's not. Why do you think I had to draw it all out for you? Well, now here's where it even gets more complicated. So if they're not going to follow the direct line, where are they going to get the next king from? Well, you know what the barons end up doing? Claim for Edward III. Okay, that's fine. There we go. They end up going to the brother of Philip IV. I suppose I'll take the line this way. The brother of Edward IV, who himself never became king, but rather he was nothing but a baron because his brother had kids. So they have to basically go back a generation. Instead of picking from one of the descendants of Philip IV, they have to pick the grandfather, the great-grandfather, Philip III, because Charles had a son named Philip. And the barons basically said his claim was stronger. The nephew of Philip IV had a stronger claim on the throne than his grandson, because it's going through men. Because some law written 1,000 years before said so.
So Charles at the throne or Philip?
Charles is dead, but his son Philip is going to get the throne, and he gets crowned Philip VI.
That means Charles is the brother of Philip IV. That has children.
Charles is the brother of Philip IV. So their common ancestor is their father, Philip III. So like I said, they pick Philip's nephew, who is only, well, that distant relation, as opposed to a grandson, who is a direct line. Now, here's the most amazing part of it all. And it should be a non-issue. We should be done. We should move on to the next topic. Because guess what Isabella does? I'm sure she was livid. I'm sure she was outraged. I'm sure she was pissed. But she did her duty, and she accepted it. She stays in Paris, kneels down before her cousin, Philip, and pays homage on behalf of her son so Edward could remain the Duke of Aquitaine and the Duke of Gascony. Now here's the big one. Questions. I'm sure your brains are like, what the hell is this guy saying? And I get it. I understand. But like I said, you're not going to have to fill this, anything like this, in on the exam.
This is the most important part. She gave up her son's claim. That's it. Because she had to.
She knew she couldn't win. All right. Now, had Edward III accepted his mother's decision, there never would have been a Hundred Years' War. Well, guess what? Just 2 years later, Edward comes to age. He actually launched a coup against his mother's boyfriend. Isabella technically was the regent, but she had been allowing her lover to be the regent. Well, Edward hated this guy, so he formed an alliance with the barons, and he seized control, even though he was still technically 2 years a minor. He still had to be a kid for two more years before he could become king, but the barons didn't care. He becomes king. He begins ruling in his own name. And he is like his mother. Fierce. Tough. But an outside event causes issues. Because that's what history is. History is never a straight line. It's never easy. See, in Edward's kingdom, he technically is the King of Scotland. He's also technically the King of Ireland. He's also technically the King of Wales, in addition to being the King of England. And the problem with all of those peoples is that they don't always submit to the control of the English. And throughout different periods of times, there were rebellions. So, in Scotland, a rebellion breaks out by the Scottish nobles against the King of Scotland, who claims the right to be King of Scotland. Well, Edward wants to be King of Scotland, so Edward supports the rebels. Because if the rebels could overthrow this guy claiming to be the King of Scotland, then he could come in and be King of Scotland, like he believes he has a right to be. The problem is the King of Scotland has an alliance with France. So the moment Edward starts helping the Scottish rebels, the French ships start attacking the English coasts. Under the orders of his second cousin, Philip VI. Well, in response, Edward starts helping French rebels who don't want to submit to Philip VI. Philip eventually finds out. He declares this a violation of Edward's oath, and he seizes Aquitaine. And the moment Philip takes Aquitaine, Edward declares war. But he doesn't declare war just to get Aquitaine back. No, 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 no. He declares war, claiming the French throne itself. Because he, as the grandson of Philip IV, is closer in right than a nephew. Hey, you have family affairs?
Family affairs, there's a family affair for you. Questions? Alright, a little more than we're going to call it a day. Not easy, huh? Think about that. I spent over an hour to get us to this point. It's how confusing it is. It's a mess.
But whose claim is legitimate?
Alright, we'll give you an overview and then we'll call it a day.
First and foremost, the Hundred Years' War lasted longer than 100 years. Technically speaking, war is declared on May 27, 1337, and war would end with formal agreement on October 19, 1453, which technically means it's 116 years, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 4 days. Because the war is so long, it actually encompasses the reigns of 5 English kings and 5 French kings. Not that you need to remember them, at least not yet. Edward III, Richard II, Henry IV, 5th and 6th of England, and on the French side, Philip VI, John II, Charles V, 6, and 7.
But truth be told, it wasn't a war. But rather, the Hundred Years' War is actually 3 separate wars back to back to back, separated by 2 periods of peace. The war itself was nothing like modern wars. But rather, it was typical of ancient wars. Meaning, there were few actual battles. It was very rare that one army lined up on one side of the field and faced off against an army on the other side of the field. Most of the Hundred Years' War was nothing but a series of sieges and political maneuverings. So there was a lot of politicking going on.
Another interesting thing about the Hundred Years' War, England actually enjoyed most of the victories. England actually won most of the actual battles that were fought. And they did so because they used better tactics. Originally, the French used the tank of the day, heavy, armored, mounted knights. Whereas the English countered with infantrymen and long pikes. Long spears that they could hold off the guys on horseback, as well as the infamous English longbow. Interestingly enough, it was actually the law in England that all boys had to be trained how to use the longbow from the moment they were strong enough to pull it back. And the English would prove its lethality on the battlefield over and over again. But ultimately, as we're going to see, French would win the war out of an intangible patriotism. La patrie. Love of their country. In the end, the French would become the first people to see themselves as a nationality. prior to this, people identified by the town or village they grew up in. That's how they saw themselves. But by the end of the Hundred Years' War, the French soldiers saw themselves as French soldiers, and they were fighting for the French king, and they were fighting an us versus them battle. We were fighting against the English, who wanted to control us.
But they also had a little bit of God on their side, and we'll see that as well.
But for those of you who are doing the Hundred Years' War, one of you, I think, is doing military tactics, another thing that helped the French by the end, the advent of modern artillery.
So you can have your long-pointed sticks. And you can have your flying wooden projectiles. But if I get a cannon, I'm going to win every single time. All right, questions? All right, when we come back, we're going to look at the start of the war itself. We'll do the first mini war. We'll do the first piece. We'll do the second mini war. And maybe we'll get to the second piece.
Those handful of you that did not send me your topics, you will do so before tonight is over. Not that I'm trying to make eye contact with two people, because there's only two of you here now. But you will do it before the end of the night, because that way I will have a smile on my face. Everybody else? See you on Thursday.
By the way, you might want to crack the book. Go through the Hundred Years' War section in, I think, the third chapter, so you can kind of follow along mentally. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, thank you.